bless you. Thanks. Good evening. My name is Scott Lee, and I am an alcoholic. And so honored to be here. And thank you all very much. I was in for a double myself. That was just, every time the lights blink, I want to say, make mine a double. So I certainly understand. Thank you. John has been a fabulous host. He picked us up to the at the airport and has fed us and taken care of us. And it's just been, it's always an honor. We're invited back. We spoke at a Florida State Convention a number of years ago. That is a big deal for an alcoholic to be invited back somewhere. I knew you'd get that. And it's certainly an honor because my wife was invited to be the Al-Anon speaker. And we've just had a grand time. Thank you so much. It's going to take me a minute. I really do appreciate it. I would like to do something else, too. I appreciated the countdown, and God bless us all, and Katie with 55 years, and our new lady, I didn't get her name, but wow, what a joy. I'd like to say thank you to the folks that did whatever you did that got the people here that have less than a year. Somebody's doing some good work around here. But one of the things I like to do on a countdown, if I don't hear it, is I like to honor the Al-Anons. Could I see your hands, the Al-Anons? Where are you? Thank you so much. Thank you. I really honor your fellowship. I couldn't live the fabulous life that I live if my wife didn't have a great Al-Anon program. I've got a sign on my desk that says, Ask Linda. That's a great Al-Anon program right there, man, because if I want to know what she thinks, I got to ask her. She's not working my case. And this may touch some of you. Her Al-Anon program is so good that if I don't ask her to, she doesn't help me look for a parking place. Ooh, yeah, that scored a couple of places. Uh-huh. Anyway, I like to open my talks with a quotation from Lois Wilson, who was asked one time what she did in the moment of silence, and she said, I invite God to the meeting. And it's not that I don't believe God's here. I do believe that. But I can tell you something special happens for me if I stop and honor that presence. And so in a few minutes, I'm going to ask for that moment of silence. Now, with this many new people in the room, it could be there's somebody here who doesn't have a God, or you got one you're afraid of, or something's not working. If that's your situation, I'd like to invite you to borrow my God for the time we're together tonight. I recommend him very highly. He's been keeping, y'all give sobriety dates here, so we don't do that at home, but I will honor it. Mine's June 28th of 84, and my home group is the back room in Nashville, Tennessee. I shouldn't, there it went, boom. I've been trying to meditate, get my mind to the place where there's nothing, you know, and just happened right here in front of you. Finally worked. Yeah, I'm sure my teacher will be excited. Thank you. I was recommending my God, and who kept me sober so long. And he also, by the way, has a great sense of humor. And if you don't think so, look around the room. Aren't we funny? I think we're hilarious. One of the other things I do in the moment of silence is I ask God to help me not judge the speaker. Now, you don't have to do that, of course. But it sure has worked for me. Let's take a couple of moments and acknowledge that presence, if you don't mind. Amen. Thank you. Thank you very much. I was asked to tell my story here tonight, and I found the directions, amazingly enough, in the Big Book. On page 29, where it says, each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. So that must be my subject. Now, I want to tell you, I did not begin my life on a quest for a relationship with God. I began my life a victim of the delusion that I could wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if only I managed well. You recognize that? It's on page 61. It says, I'm so psycho that I have failed to notice that I got what I wanted tens of thousands of times and I wasn't happy. I'm a poor observer. And I'll give you a couple examples just so you can follow along. And I didn't fly this far to talk to you, by the way. I come to talk with you. So we're going to play together tonight. So just for an example, Who here, when you were a child, wanted a bicycle? You were sure if you could get a bicycle, you'd be happy, and you got a bike. Let me see him. Come on. Thank you. Are you happy? Oh, let's try another one. Which one of you guys wanted her, you girls wanted him, you're sure you could get him, you'd be happy, and you got him. Let's see it. All right, now I'm going to give you a break. You could be sitting next to him, so I'm not going to ask. Oh, who was sure if you could get rid of him or her, you'd be happy? Okay. So I have to embrace the great truth, and the great truth is that I had pleasure and happiness confused. I think pleasure's on the physical plane. There's something out there that can bring it, and it's of a limited duration. Happiness is an internal thing. I think it's a side effect of having a healthy relationship with God and with all of you, and that's at least in part what the 12 steps are about. I'm going to talk about drinking for just a couple of minutes. I didn't start drinking until I was 18 years old, and it's because I didn't know what it would do. I needed a drink way before then. The first day that I'm absolutely certain that I needed a drink was the morning I went to kindergarten that first day. That double you were talking about would have been perfect that morning. But I didn't know what it would do. I went away to college the summer I turned 18. I was out and I was in fraternity rush. I wanted to be in a fraternity. Out with the fraternity boys, they started drinking beer, so I started drinking beer. And I didn't like the way it tasted. I did not like the way the bubbles felt going down. I didn't like the fullness that it gave me. But somewhere between the first sip and the bottom of the second beer, I got magic. And all of the alcoholics in the room know what I'm talking about. Something inside me let go and went, ah, yeah. And I was just all of a sudden taller. Did anybody else get taller? Ed, you didn't get taller? Did you get shorter? Okay. Anybody else get shorter? We have a shorter in the front row. One more over here. Okay. And better looking. Did you get, huh? Could you, my pimples fell right. I was just amazed at how handsome I was. I wish you could have seen me. And expert on many subjects. Did you get smart? Oh, I already got some doubles back here. I got two up right here. He still got them up, too. Look at this. Oh, yeah, yeah. Right. Fantastic dancer. Yeah, a lot of dancers. Uh-huh, you betcha. Lubricated lips. Could you talk to the opposite sex? Yes, that happened too. But the biggest thing that it did for me is it made me feel suddenly like I was as good as everybody else. That was a new feeling for me. I had never had it, ever. And I don't know how this happened to me, but sometime when I was a very small boy, I became convinced that I was defective. There are things wrong with me that can never be repaired. And if you all ever find out who I really am, you'll run me off, because a bunch of together people like you wouldn't have a broken model like me around. And I became an actor as a small boy. And my act was I pretended to be whoever I thought the people right in front of me wanted me to be, which means I'm a different guy to everybody. Very different. And my greatest fear was that people from different segments of my life would be at the same place at the same time. How would I act, right? Because I'm acting all the time. And when I get to you, the only thing I know for sure about me is that I'm defective. And if you find out who I am, you'll run me off. And so I'm looking for an act that you'll like. It's my experience that the act won't get sober. And but anyway, back to the college guys and that second beer and boom. All of a sudden, I went from, I'm afraid they're going to see through my act and run me off, to, these turkeys are pretty lucky I'm here. If you don't recognize that, that's an entire psychic change. That's exactly what that is. And I think that's why Dr. Silkworth says that's why I got to have an entire psychic change to get over alcoholism, is because that's what alcohol gave me. It gave me a badly needed entire psychic change. I chased it hard. I zipped through a 4-year college and 5 years and 2 summer schools. Thank you. Yeah, all right. And the United States Air Force in the mid-60s was using the mirror test. They put a little makeup mirror under your nostrils. If you could fog it, they would take you. And I fogged one. They took me. And they commissioned me a second lieutenant, sent me to Valdosta, Georgia, at Air Force pilot training, Moody Air Force Base. And we flew the Cessna 172 for about 6 weeks. We moved to the T-37, which is a twin-engine jet about 300 miles an hour wide open. It's fully acrobatic. And we flew that about 4.5 months. And then for the last 6 months of that year, we flew the T-38, which you're all familiar with. You may not know it, but you are. You saw Top Gun, right? Everybody saw Top Gun? Okay. At the beginning, the end of the movie had the dogfight with the MiGs. The Russian government didn't loan Hollywood any MiGs, folks. That black airplane was the T-38. It's today still the Air Force's advanced jet trainer. The Thunderbirds flew this plane for 7 years. When this plane came into the inventory, it took the climb record away from the F-104. I have on a number of occasions taken the active runway and released the brakes and lit the afterburners and leveled off at 40,000 feet in 3.5 minutes. Yeah, they don't have that ride at the fair. They ain't got that one, baby. No, no. And this thing has a roll rate of 720 degrees a second. Yeah, that's twice around every second. And I'll tell you right now, your eyeballs won't track that if you're sober. I mean, it's just, this is a blur. And a loop in this plane, a loop is defined as a 360 degree turn through the vertical plane pulling positive G's. At 10,000 feet, you enter at 500 knots. It's about 550 miles an hour, and you pull up at 5 G's. I'm going to tell you what that means. You're pulling 1 G right now. At 1 G, a 200-pound man weighs 200 pounds. At 5 G's, a 200-pound man weighs 1,000 pounds. That's exactly what that means. That includes, by the way, your upper eyelids. And you'll be aware of that at 5 G's as you struggle to keep them open. Okay, 10,000 feet, 500 knots, 5 G's. We're wings level inverted at 20,000 feet. Took 10,000 feet to pull her over on her back. We lose 8,000 feet coming down the backside. Total elapsed time on the maneuver under 25 seconds. I tell you all of that about the airplane for two reasons. The first one, of course, is to impress you. Mine's up. I'm up. We ought to get one of those. Yeah. And the other one is because I think it tells the story of my alcoholism so well. I come down from a day of flying that airplane. About 5:30, I head for the officers' club. I'm going to socialize with the other pilots of my squadron. I don't plan to get drunk this particular night. Used to plan to get drunk a lot. I mean, that's the mission. I'm going out tonight to get drunk. If that's not why you're going, I don't want you along. But I also used to get drunk by mistake. Did you ever just kind of take drunk? Anybody that ever happened to you? Yeah. Like maybe the guy in the next bar stool could have been contagious or something like that. Do you understand? Okay. Well, I tell you what. Would you be willing to do audience participation with me? Yeah. Let's try that again. Audience participation. Yeah. All right. Thank you. When I point at you, when you fill in the blanks, you know all the answers, okay? Now, I got a flight tomorrow morning, by the way, at 7:30 in that airplane. Okay? Clearly not going to get drunk tonight, but I do want to socialize with my friends, so I'm going to have one beer, no more than two. Right. Very good. Now, it's good to have a plan. I noticed some of you Al-Anons didn't play. Now, I won't be offended if you pick up the ball here, but you know all of these answers. This is what you heard on the phone. And you believed it again. That's why you have to come to Al-Anon. The ones that went screaming from guys like me don't have to come to your thing, do they? No. Okay, let's. Here we go. One beer, no more than... Yeah. I should be home by 6:30, no later than... Yeah. Sure. That's the plan. But somewhere between the first sip of the first beer and the bottom of the second beer, I get this phenomenon of craving. Dr. Silkworth talks about the doctor's opinion, and I don't get home by 7. I leave the officers' club at exactly 1 o'clock in the morning because they... John, this is one of the biggest groups of pilots I've ever spoken to. I drive home with a hand over one eye. Who knows why? Okay. For those of you who don't, it will keep that single center line from crossing itself. We don't know how it does that. Right. I walk into the house. My first wife tears into me. There's a lot of information in that sentence if you play it back. And then I head into the bathroom for my after drinking chores. Yes. I thought the two greatest inventions of the 20th century, both invented by alcoholics, I believe, were the first one was that little half-moon shape of carpet they put around the commode for you to kneel on. That was invented by one of our guys. You know, his knees were all torn up from the bathroom floor. He said, we ought to put... And that soft commode seat you could rest your head on when you're kind of in... Yeah. Now tell me alcoholics aren't creative. I mean, come on. You know, because see the hands of the pukers? Come on. Yes, all right. All right. It's going to get tougher now. How about nose pukers? Ever come out your nose? Come on. Yes. Oh, yeah. One of the things you'll notice about nose pukers is the nose pukers always quit forever when they're puking out their nose. Some of your regular pukers are iffy on that, but your nose pukers are about 1,000 on it, right? You know, that's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Who quit forever? Solemn oath on the Bible in front of witnesses more than once. Yeah. You know what I noticed not too long ago is that I actually meant it every time I quit forever. I actually meant it. I mean, whether I was in a crack or not, I actually meant it. All right, here's a tougher one. All right, who peed in the closet? I'm so embarrassed for you, I never did that. That's awful. Yeah, there's a big difference between sharing in a meeting and a fifth step. You might want to talk to your sponsor before you share that kind of thing in public. I'm embarrassed for you. I never did that. That is awful. My first wife is still angry about that coffee table that used to be in the living room. Okay, I'll give you that. Who here is doing corrections? Who's doing corrections work? Thanks for serving. Yeah. I have the privilege of doing that. Yeah. You know, you can't rocket into the fourth dimension if you stay in first gear. You might, if you're, by the way, suffering from depression, you might want to get with one of these people who's taking the meetings into the jails and take a meeting in. It'll break a depression faster than anything I know of. And unlike a lot of what's being prescribed for us, it won't have a negative impact on your recovery. Now, forgive the soapbox. That's my experience. Such a privilege for me to do it. And the thing that reminded me of it is I did that gag about who peed in the closet in Depod in the county jail about a year and a half ago for the first time. I just ad-libbed it. 25 inmates in there. One guy puts his hand up, right? And I wore him out just like I did you. Now, they don't laugh that much in the jail, but they did that night. And when the laughter finally died down, this inmate looked at me and says, hey, man, no big deal. It wasn't my closet. True story. Okay, so I'm in there puking my guts out, quitting forever. And then I would pray the pre-AA prayer. Now, it's not the literature. I'm calling it the pre-AA prayer. We're going to do it together. I'm going to do the first line. You're going to do the second. Are you ready? God, get me out of this. Blech. You left that out. That's alcoholic for amen. Right? Sure it is. Sure. And I brush my teeth and go to bed. It's got to be 2 in the morning, 2:30, maybe 3 o'clock. I get up at 6. Ouch. Yeah. In that wonderland between drunk and hungover. I miss that so much. And at 7:30 that morning, I'm in that airplane I was telling you about. Yeah. And we're going to go do things that the roller coaster won't do. Uh-huh. Just after liftoff, oh, we're in a two-ship formation today. Have you ever been to an air show? Seen what they did? We did that. And just after liftoff, I've tucked under the leader's tail. And if I can stand up in my cockpit, I can almost touch his afterburners. We're going to be pulling 5 G's going over the top. Mm. And I am dying in this airplane, all right? I've got the Force 5 hangover. You remember that one? It's the one where the butcher knife goes in here, comes out the back? Remember that one? I was surprised the helmet went on over it. And the eyelids are made out of sandpaper. I got a tremor in my hands. I'm sweating booze out of every pore. My throat and nasal passages are raw. I have selected 100% on the oxygen lever. It will not cure a hangover. I've talked to Sandy and Lyle and a bunch of our other pilots, and they'll all tell you it won't cure a hangover. And we have collectively tried it thousands of times. And not once. It won't do it. And I'm dying in that airplane doing acrobatics in formation. And the only thing that keeps me going is the sure and certain knowledge that I will never feel this way in a plane again. Because you see, last night I quit forever and I meant it with all my heart. Yeah. And that's what keeps me going. I've got a friend that says that he believes the reason non-alcoholics don't become alcoholics is because they don't have the willpower for it. Because that's what I just described for you as willpower. That's what it is. He said, you take your non-alcoholic, he goes out on prom night, he drinks a pint and a half of Jack Daniels, he pukes on his date's dress, he wrecks his truck, he wakes up at the drunk tank, he says, I'm never doing that again, and he never does. Obvious lack of willpower. Okay, so I'm dying in this airplane. By 5:30 that afternoon, my 22-year-old body is resilient. It's coming back. I'm not well yet, but it's coming back. I'll tell you, one thing I know for sure is I ain't getting drunk tonight. No way am I getting drunk tonight, but I do want to socialize with the other pilots in my squadron. I think I'll drop by the club and have one beer, no more than... I should be home by 6:30, no later than... But I leave the club at exactly 1 because they... And I drive home drunk and I listen to her and I puke my guts out and God get me out of this. Oh, very good on the amen. Yes. You bet. Over and over again. Over and over again. And I can't see into the past all the way to yesterday and say, weren't you dying of a hangover when we released the brakes yesterday and the day before and every day last week and every day last month? And I was powerless over alcohol, and I was ignorant of that fact. And that's a tough combination. I have a certificate at home framed that says I'm a distinguished graduate from Air Force Pilot Training. There were 4 of those in my class of 50. I just had the gift. Some guys can hit a golf ball 300 yards. I can drive an airplane. That's all. And I was to fly for 4 more years. And I'm not going to tell any more flying stories. I'd love to. Meet me in the lobby. We'll do it all night. But I want to talk more recovery, so I'm going to skip some of the drunkologue that I tell occasionally. But I finally got out of the Air Force because I had to. I at one point was flying a mission that was classified above top secret and some stuff. They're kind of finicky about those. And I was so drunk taxiing my plane out at 4 o'clock one morning, I taxied it off into the weeds. Couldn't keep it on the pavement. Possibly some of you have had that experience with other types of vehicles. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. I'm an unconvicted felon. And if, if it'd been 4 in the afternoon instead of 4 in the morning, or there'd been a plane taxiing behind mine, a rock, a ditch, a stump, or a cliff, somebody else would be here, I'd still be in Leavenworth. And that's one of the reasons I carried the meetings into the jail. I've never been arrested. Never been arrested. Don't need to be arrested to be effective taking meetings into the jail. The guys in the jail already know how to get arrested. They did not need your help for that. Truly, it's one of my passions. But anyway, I got out of the Air Force and I had an honorable discharge. I used to sit in cockpits and say to people, I can't believe they pay us to do this. And I walked away from it. I had to. And I got a job as a sales rep. I got a business partner. We started making some money in the summer of 1984. He figured out what was wrong with me as he went through family week with his wife. And he said, you're going into treatment as fast as I can put you there. We're done. You're fired. Man was a great communicator. And you see how I could make a living selling. I mean, he could really explain it to you. And so on June 28th of 84, I signed into Ridgeview. It's a little treatment center, little charm school outside of Atlanta, Georgia. And I was told later I was one of the saddest looking people that ever came through the door. The reason, of course, is because I was one of the saddest people that ever came through the door. When they told me I couldn't drink Miller High Life or Scotch on the Rocks or smoke homemade cigarettes, I didn't think I was ever going to have any more fun. We don't have time tonight for me to tell you all of the things that I was wrong about when I got here. And that was just one of them. I hadn't had any fun yet, and I didn't know it. This has been an astounding ride for me. Anyway, I didn't sleep the first 3 nights I was in treatment, and they say that's pretty common for people doing the kinds of things I was doing. So I'm laying there the 4th night, lights out at 11, you got to stay in the bunk until 6:30 in the morning, and I know I'm not going to sleep again. And some of you may recall, if you're not drinking and you're not sleeping, it stays dark a long time. And I didn't do this, but what happened to me was a review of my life. I was able to see my life in small vignettes, a little piece at a time. I didn't do it on purpose. This just happened over the course of several hours. And I had always given myself credit for my intentions. I'm probably the best intended person you've ever met. My favorite, I used to do close-up magic, and my favorite intention was that one of these days I was going to get a clown suit. And when I was on the road, instead of running the saloons, I'm going to put on the clown suit and go to a children's hospital, take my kid in, and do a magic show for the kids. Yeah, I mean, you got to admit, it'd take a really spectacular guy to do that. I haven't done it yet, by the way. Our third step talks about a decision. For me, the difference between an intention and a decision is an intention is followed by more intentions. A decision, that's followed by action. That's the difference. And this night, when this review happened to me, I couldn't see the intentions. They were gone. And I was stuck with the reality. And it wasn't pretty. I got to the place where I started thinking about the worst thing I've ever done. I have one. Stands alone. I'd always been able to stop it before. Three fast scotches to do that. Six-pack, take that right away. Man, I'm laying in a bunk in a treatment center. I can't get it to stop. And I reached... We talk about bottom here. I don't see the definition of bottom in my literature, so I'm going to tell you my experience with it is that bottom wasn't on the physical plane. Bottom's in here. Bottom was when I hated my guts at such a level and was so repulsed by the things that I had done that I would have paid any price and done anything not to be me. That was bottom for me. And at that point, I assume it was my soul, because as strange as this is going to sound, this happened in here. Something in here screamed very loudly to a God I'm not sure I believed in. God, forgive me, like that, but real loud. And in here, it didn't happen up here. And what I'm about to tell you all happened in the next instant. Suddenly, there was this magnificent light shining just on me and on my bed. And with my eyes closed, I could see the room a good bit more clearly than I can see this one. Eyes closed. Physically, it was like there was a... when you've had x-rays taken of your teeth, and when they finish, you've got that lead apron affair laying on you. They picked at it. It felt like something heavy was laying on my body, all over me, that I was unaware of, that flew off of me at the same moment. And I lay in the presence of infinite love. And I knew in that moment that there was a God, that that God had the power to forgive me, and that I was forgiven. And I knew that all at once. I think I took the first three steps. And I lay there in the Master's presence for a while. And I've talked to others who've had similar experiences who agree when I say what we call time doesn't exist in that presence. And I cannot explain that to you, but it doesn't. And I lay there with him for a while, and I don't know how long. And after that, I must have slept, because the next morning I woke up, and I hadn't done that in several days. And I woke up wanting to be one of his guys. And that was my first cornerstone. And thank you. Wow. For those of you who feel you may have been shorted because you haven't had one of those, I think I was near death. This is page 12 in the text. But soon the sense of his presence had been blotted out by worldly clamors, mostly those within myself. I want to tell you that I do not believe that experience alone would have kept me sober these past 21 years. I don't believe that. I don't believe it at all. It was necessary for me to do the rest of this. That was simply a beginning for me. And anyway, about 2 weeks later, I was called into my counselor's office, and I'd like to salute the Al-Anons again. My counselor was a member of Al-Anon, and he's the reason I stand here. And it was this particular counseling session. He was working on my aftercare plan. And the purpose of the appointment, 11 o'clock in the morning, was for me to go in there and talk about the aftercare plan. And I knew that. So I went in there to help him design this aftercare plan. If you're new and you're not sure why that's funny, please, please try to listen to this, okay? And I explained to him coming through the door, I wasn't taking an abuse, I wasn't going to halfway house, and they had a 28-day program, and that's as long as I was staying. And I just did it to lay out the parameters to help the man do his job. I was just being helpful. And he said, you've left out something you're not going to do. I said, what? He said, you're not going to make it. I took that personally. And I'm not a violent man as a rule, but I make exceptions. And I made one for him. And it was a verbal one. And I said to him, why'd you say that? Boy, is that ever not a quote. And because I find the language of the heart to be different from the language of the gutter, so I can't quote myself on that one. But trust me, it wasn't pretty. It was flowery, but it wasn't pretty. And I said, why'd you say that to me? And he asked the question that changed my life. He said, if you already know how to run a program to keep yourself sober, how is it you happen to be a patient here? And I responded by very cleverly saying, and nothing came out. I'd never had the experience before. Didn't you always have an answer? I mean, you had to make some up, but didn't you always have an answer? I always had an answer. I can't answer this. And I spent the rest of that day, my body went where it was supposed to be. I went to lunch and phys ed and the movie, and I don't know what we did. My mind was in that man's office trying to answer the unanswerable question. And about 9 o'clock that night, just about dusk, I'm walking back to my cottage, and the answer struck me in the chest. It did not appear here. This part of me knew before this part. It was like I was walking and something was flying through the air and slammed into my chest. And the answer was and is, I don't know how to run a program to keep myself sober. And if I'm going to be one of the very few that make it, I'm going to have to do it all. This is not a cafeteria lunch for a guy like me where I can take what I want and leave the rest. I have to win this time. I must win now. I've never done this before. I'm a man. Ask a question. I'm sober since my very first AA meeting. Who else here is sober since their very first AA meeting? Okay, newcomers, you do not have to relapse. It's not part of the deal. I'm not cracking on you if you have. If you have, God bless you. I'm so glad you're back. So many of us are in the jails and in the graveyards because we didn't get back. I'm glad you're here. I want the new people to know it's not necessary to relapse. It hadn't been for me in about half this place, I think. Pretty good number. So it wasn't necessary. But it has been necessary for me to follow instructions. I don't do that by nature. It was necessary. And at that point, when I got that peace, that I'm not going to get to run this thing, I surrendered to what I today lovingly call Step 1, Section B. Aha! I was confused. I thought the word therefore appeared in the first step. Powerless over alcohol, therefore our lives have become unmanageable. On close examination, I have discovered the word therefore does not appear in the first step. There's actually a hyphen in there, which I looked up in the dictionary under punctuation, that connects two separate thoughts. The reason I was confused was that on June the 27th, 1984, the fact that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life was a disaster were related. On August the 6th, 2005, the fact that I am powerless over alcohol, my life is unmanageable, are unrelated. They're still true. My life's no longer insane. But I can't find a place in this book that says, congratulations, having now achieved this lofty spiritual level, your life is now manageable by you. The tank's full, the keys are in it, go get them. Write if you find work. Because one of the first things I did when I woke up this morning is I invited God in to run my life. Not to give me some help, Bush League pitch hitters, what the 12 and 12 says. No, no. I asked Him to run it, all of it. Yeah, it's a whole different thing from asking for a little bit of help. See, the few times that I prayed before I got here were me giving God instructions. You know, big fella, take a knee. A couple of things here I want you to, you know, hear your instructions. The typical pre-AA prayers, get me out of this, I'll never do it again. Please don't let her be pregnant. And hey, recognize that one, didn't you? And help me pass this test I didn't study for. They're fairly, but that's me telling God what to do. And in those days when I prayed, I was trying to make Him my God. What we're doing here today is to trying to make me His man. Big difference is this one works. You might want to consider that. It's been important to me to try to just do it that way. But I surrendered to the second half of that first step. And I let my sponsor run my program. And I'm doing it his way. See, my disease still lives up here. It's healthy. It's doing push-ups. And when I commit to do what my sponsor says, not to run my life, but to run my recovery program, I take my disease out of the decision-making process as it affects my recovery. That's working for me. But my life's not insane anymore because we don't have an idiot running it. I fired me as general manager of my own life. Working good. You might want to think about that. It's sure been good for me. Anyway, I zipped through the 28-day treatment program in 6 weeks flat. And I've always been a quick study. And went back to Nashville where the only guy I knew in the whole city that was in recovery owned one of the businesses I called on, and I didn't want him to know. If you don't recognize that, that's newcomer thinking, terminal case. Yeah. I set out to follow the aftercare plan. They said, stay away from your old playmates and playgrounds. My favorite watering hole in Nashville is on 8th Avenue South. And I had a 2-year chip in my pocket the next time my vehicle was on 8th Avenue South. I'm not kidding. I did not even allow my vehicle to turn onto the street for over 2 years. They told me to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I tried. I got to 87, and it's been too long. I've lost the other two. But there was one particular night I was literally saying, okay, where are the keys? And I'm on the way to the meeting, and my son decided to learn to dance standing up in a rocking chair. And we went to the emergency room instead of the meeting. I think everybody here would say it was a good call. So I missed that night. And I didn't know you could go to two meetings in a day. I thought if you missed, you just missed. Because I got newcomer thinking, terminal case. And I completed this psychobabble force that I don't even want to call it that. They call it a four-step. I refuse to do that. It was a bunch of, you know, do you still hate your mother, fill in the blanks, multiple choice, psychobabble. I'd like to recommend the actual four steps in the book, by the way. That's one of our best-kept secrets. One of the best-kept secrets we got, the four steps in the book. And it's a series of lists, observations, and prayers. It's been my experience that the observations and prayers are life-changing. If you don't know what I'm talking about, please get with someone who does. The forgiveness process is in the fourth step. Find out if you don't know what we're talking about here. Anyway, I completed that thing, and I called down to the treatment center. Bernie had not been my counselor, but I had asked him, he was a counselor there, and I'd asked him if he'd hear my fifth step before I left there. The reason I chose him is you could look at him and tell he was stoned. Well, you know what it looks like. He's got this dumb grin. His face is real relaxed. When he moves real slow. I thought, I'm going to do my fifth step with this junkie. 2 weeks later, will he know what I said? He won't even know if we did it. So I thought, newcomer thinking. It was pretty solid. So Bernie said, sure. I drove down to Atlanta, did my fifth step with Bernie, which is where I began to get relief. If you're new and you've looked at the steps and they look to you like they're designed to punish you, welcome to AA. That's how they look to us. We were wrong about that. You are too. Because if I'd been doing the steps with a sponsor before then, I'd have been getting relief up to there. Because that's what the steps do. Anyway, I got a lot of relief doing step five. And I had, and by the way, just as an aside, Bernie wasn't stoned. Bernie was sober over 20 years. That was serenity. I didn't know what it looked like. Newcomer thinking, okay? I get back to Nashville, and the only thing I haven't done on my aftercare plan is get a sponsor. Well, see, this is a little bit harder fill-in-the-blank. Well, see, if you can do this, this is a two-word fill-in-the-blank. Newcomer thinking, crazy, okay? I'm so crazy, I'm looking for a sponsor I can relate to. Exactly. Oh, how crazy is that? I mean, what insanity. Think about it for a minute. I can't figure out you go to two meetings in a day. Who can I relate to? Oh, yeah. I can relate to the squirrel on the next branch that doesn't know his fanny from a hot rock. Who I can relate to. Oh, thank God I didn't find a sponsor I could relate to. We'd both be dead. I found a sponsor I would obey. It was a new concept for me. And I asked Jerry, I said, would you sponsor me? And he said, here's your first assignment. Assignment? I thought a sponsor was like a big brother, going to kind of show you the ropes, maybe loan you some money, fix your wife, that sort of thing. No, I was wrong about that too. Ask me later, I can't take the time. I did the assignment, I came back to him, I said, I did the assignment. He said, I'll sponsor you my way. I said, what does that mean exactly? He said, you are too sick to stay sober on the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. You will need the program also. And I didn't have any idea what he was talking about. And he said he thought it was the best-kept secret we had in the entire fellowship. The way we keep it secret is we read it at almost every meeting. It's on page 59. It says, here are the steps we took which are suggested as a... No steps, no program. Steps aren't part of the program. They are the program. I don't do this to be argumentative. If I've got something more important to say, or if anybody did, I don't know what it is. I have personally not yet seen anyone in and out of the program, in and out of the fellowship I see every day. I have not seen anyone actually do the steps out of this book or take them. It's not learn them, understand them, or interpret them, okay? But actually do the steps, take the steps out of this book, while being coached by a sponsor who has already taken the steps out of this book. Stay active, carrying our message, and drink again. Has anyone here seen that? Y'all been putting your hands up all night. There's 2,000 people in this room, I would guess. No hands. I would say that we as a group stand by the first line of chapter 5. Rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed our path. All right? This is not some get it and some don't. In my experience, it's some do it and some don't. I think it's a lock. If you get a sponsor that's already done these steps and allow yourself to be coached through them and stay active doing what we do, I don't think it's possible to miss. It's that powerful. It's that powerful. I don't like it when somebody says in and out of the program because I don't believe in it. And forgive the soapbox, but I think it's pretty important. But anyway, he said, you're going to have to do the 12 steps. I was honest with my sponsor. I like to recommend that. I said, Jerry, I don't want to do the 12 steps. He said, that's okay. I said, good. He said, as long as you do them. Jerry, I don't think we're communicating. Yeah, we are. We're communicating. That's the definition of willingness. Willingness is when I do what my sponsor says, whether I want to or not. What a definition, huh? Jerry, why do I have to do the 12 steps? Yeah. Jerry did not answer why questions from the men that he sponsored, with this exception, and I don't either. And it's for the same reason. He says, step one, section B says, you're not in management. Why is a management question? Consequently, all of the questions begin with why have the same answer. And the answer is, you don't need to know. I didn't like that when I first heard it. Today it's one of my cornerstones because I always thought it was not knowing that made me crazy. Uh-uh. It was needing to know that was making me crazy. See, that need to know is me playing God, and part of step three was me agreeing to quit playing God. Kind of an important thing there. That I got to say something else, too. We're committing murder, in my opinion, with a phrase, and the phrase is don't drink and go to meetings. You'll die from that. You'll die from that. Now, having said that, I do recommend not drinking, and I do recommend a lot of meetings. But if sitting with a bunch of other alcoholics talking about our problems is going to get people sober, the guys under the Woodland Street Bridge in Nashville, Tennessee, be sober right this second. Because that's who they are. That's what they're doing. It doesn't work for them, and it doesn't work for us. I think that's really, really important stuff. But anyway, I said, why do I have to do the 12 steps? And he said, this is the only why you're ever going to get out of me. He said, think of yourself as a garbage can. Only easy assignment the man ever gave me. He said, what we're going to do with this garbage can of you is we're going to dump you out. We're going to scrub the can and stand it back upright. We're going to fish through it. Most of your life is garbage, and we're going to throw it away. But portions of it are good. We'll keep them. He said, do you love your children? I said, very much. It's great. We'll keep that. When we get finished with this can, you're going to be a big, clean can with just a little good stuff in the bottom. Because our program's kind of like going to the dentist. We've got to drill before we can fill. We've got to dig the poison out of your soul. That's what 4 through 10 are about. They're about digging the poison out of your soul. Because if we just try to fill with the good stuff, the sickness is still in there. It's going to detonate one of these days. The good news is we got Novocaine. We call it home group. We call it sponsorship. We call it fellowship. We call it love. It's not that hard. And the reason that you have to do that is because alcohol's not your problem. What? Alcohol's not your problem. It's your answer. It's what makes you tall enough and smart enough and good looking enough. And it makes your skin fit. It's your answer. And when we say to you, lay down booze, we haven't said put down your problem. That's why non-alcoholics don't understand. They've said to me, lay down your answer. And if I'm going to do that, I'm going to have a new answer. And it's going to have to be at least as good as the old one. Because if I wasn't the kind of guy that needed an answer, I'd have never been an alcoholic. It's that simple. I think for me, the most powerful promise we have... See, I could quit, as you know, forever, several thousand times. But I couldn't get unthirsty. This was the piece I couldn't find. I would quit for 20 minutes to about 8 weeks. That 8 weeks is a pretty good forever, don't you think? Yeah, you wouldn't believe how long the earthlings think that forever goes on a lot. But I couldn't get unthirsty and stay that way. Something's coming. You know, I've been 3 weeks not even thinking about a drink, but I'm going to get her, or I'm going to make too much money, or I'm going to buy a boat, or the Redskins are going to play the Cowboys on Monday night, right? Something's going to happen. I'm going to get thirsty. And I've been hearing them all for all these years saying one day at a time, but under their breath, newcomers, they're whispering something else. They're saying one day at a time in a row. See, that's what they really mean, is one day at a time in a row. So if I'm going to have to do that, they're going to have to get me unthirsty permanently. I'd like to quote what for me is the most powerful promise we have. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. I had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, and I was rendered unthirsty. Spiritually awakened alcoholics, in my experience, do not drink beverage alcohol, and they don't ever get thirsty, no matter what. No matter what. And that's been my experience with it. I allowed him to coach me through that. I think he saved my life, and I think he may have saved several more. He said, the reason you have to do this is one of these days, something's just going to slam your heart. He said, your father's going to die. And on that day, if you don't have that big, clean, empty can with just a little good stuff in the bottom, but you get that clean, empty space to store that pain in while we love you back to spiritual health, if you don't have that, you'll escape. That's what you are. You're an escape artist. And the only escapes you know are killing you and devastating everyone around you. And I let him coach me through the steps. I'm going to tell you a terrible story. It has a happy ending. Hang on to that. Sometime the night of July 4th of 1993, my precious daughter fired a pistol into her mouth. And I found her, we don't know how much later, and we rushed to Vanderbilt Hospital. Within 20 minutes, there was 20 or 30 of you in the lobby by dark. It looked just like this. And I don't know how long that prayer meeting lasted. They told us for the first 4 days that she would not live, and I didn't say may. They said, we can't save her. 4 days is a very long time to be at your baby's bed. Now, she can't talk. She's got tubes stuck in her, and she's a nightmare to look at. But she can squeeze your hand once for yes and twice for no, and she don't want to die anymore. 4 days is a long time. And I believe if I hadn't had that can to store that pain in, I probably would have committed murder sometime within the next day or two after that, and this story would not have the happy ending that it does. My daughter sends you love. She's doing great. She's blind in one eye. That's all she's lost. Her neurosurgeons will tell you that that's not possible. But you know what happened. So many new people here, I'm going to tell you this because you may not know who you are yet, and I'd like for you to know. My home group put a 24-hour watch on me. I left that hospital once within the next day or two to go home and get clothing. And I came back, and I didn't leave the hospital for 60 days. 60 days, I never left the hospital. And there was not a time in the next 60 days there wasn't a member of my home group as closest to me as I am to Ed right here. 60 days, 24 hours a day. Not to keep me from drinking. They didn't talk about that. So one of my people would be there to hold me at 4 in the morning if I needed to cry. One of my people would be there. They tell me you can pretend to care. You cannot pretend to show up. And I am so proud to be a member of an organization of people who show up. You showed up. I owe a debt I can't repay. I have permission to tell any story I tell here, by the way. My closest friend in Nashville, his son did not live. And we 24-houred him for a long time. Emotionally, he was gone for a very long time. He did not drink again. Don't hear that. He's carrying a 19-year chip. He deserves to be. But emotionally, he was gone. You could get up in his face and yell, and he couldn't hear you for a very long time. He's back now. He's doing fantastic. And as a matter of fact, he and I are doing something here with Keith in January. He's the other fellow that's going to be on that book weekend. But he said it this way. He said, one of these days you're going to have to go to the mountain all by yourself. If you haven't done the work out of this book and you don't know how to reach up and take God's hand, you won't be able to go. I believe that. I sponsored two men who've had teenage sons killed in recovery. They did not get thirsty. All right? This thing absolutely works. It absolutely works. When I first got to recovery in Nashville, I started going to a clubhouse, and they had slogans on the wall. And one of them said, first things first. I said, all right, I understand that one. Of course, I'm not doing it. I'm a newcomer. But I understood it. And one of them said, let go and let God. I wonder how they do that. And one of them said, one day at a time. I said, okay, I know that means don't drink today. But it means more than that, I've discovered. My experience is that with the first 10 steps, I've cleaned up my past. There's nothing gaining on me. I don't have to look over my shoulder at all. I think steps 11 and 12 are about me embracing the wondrous truth that this loving God holds my future. I got a friend at home says he spends too much time in his head trying to clear away the wreckage of his future. Yeah. Okay. Past is clean. Loving God holds the future. Those two facts free me to live one day at a time in this day. If I don't have both of those in place, I can't be here. And it's important that I don't borrow pain from the past or from the future. Because if I borrow enough and bring it into today, I can make myself crazy. And that's what happens when I get out of today. But they had another slogan up there in the wall that just, it made me even nuts to look at it. It was the only one I was doing. You know which one it was, don't you? Think. Oh, my head was a very busy place. Yeah. If you're new here, if you believe what I'm about to say, you'll be impressed. If you believe it, I won't be offended if you don't. I only have one thought at a time. And sometimes there's a space between them. It's just quiet. Stick around. Oh, wow. But anyway, I don't find the definition on that think in the literature. And I've taken it upon myself. You're welcome to this if you can use it. Think. What that means is three thinks is the limit. I can think about it once, that's good. Twice is good. I can think about it the third time. Once I've thought about it three times, I must lay it down. For if I were going to outthink it, I would have outthunk it in three thinks. If I go to the fourth think, I got a problem with step one, section B. I'm trying to manage it. Mm-hmm. That's right. Oh, a lot of peace in that. Yeah. As a matter of fact, every problem I got today is a 1B problem. If I'm upset about it, it's because I'm trying to manage it. From everything from international politics to the way you drive your car to the fact that, boy, and boy, am I so honored. What a great turnout for the Al-Anon speaker this afternoon. That speaks very highly of the recovery around here. I want you to know that. And but this fabulous Al-Anon that I'm married to, she puts a toilet paper on the roll backwards is what she does. It should feed over the top, as you well know. Should be right over the top. I fixed the ones in the men's room. But it should. She says she puts it on the other way because we've got a cat, but I've been watching that cat for 8 years. He don't use it. I believe laughter is the sound effect of recovery. Thank you. I really love it. I moved out of the home my first wife and I were living in when I was sober 6 years. And the reason I moved out is that I was about to hit her. And I realized it, just a flash of clarity. And she told one of the children not too long ago that when I got sober, I changed, and she didn't. I think that might be right. But I couldn't take it. And I realized I'm about to strike her, and she's on the way to the hospital. I'm on the way to the jail. It's a bad plan. And so I did about face and walked out and got in the car, started looking for an apartment. 48 hours later, I moved. And I didn't know what to do. I'm not a religious man, but I don't believe in divorce. And yet I knew if I lived where there's a question of time, where I was going to hit her. And I was given a gift, and I share it with you only that maybe you'll be able to use it. And the gift was three prayers I prayed each morning. The first one was, God, if it's your will for us to be together, put us together. And the second one, God, if it's your will for us to be apart, put us apart. Those are the easy ones. Here's the one that counts. God, if it's your will for me not to know today, leave me not knowing. For me, that's step one, section B in prayer form. I believe God's guidance will be here right on time. Yeah. And me trying to extract guidance from the future, that's me trying to manage, and that's no good. It'll be here right on time. And I was at peace about that for several years before I got to clarity and realized couldn't be fixed. And I pray for her, and I wish her the best. I'm not taking her inventory. I really do. I wish her the best. But I sure have got a deal. Those of you who heard the Al-Anon speaker, trust me. I'm going to tell you, Lindaism, this has nothing to do with recovery. I'm just going to make you laugh. This is a cheap laugh. I'm watching the U.S. Open golf tournament last year with the sound off. My wife is spending time with her husband. Right. She's sitting next to me. Right. She could have been talked out of the golf tournament, I think. There was a Japanese fellow who was in contention. I mean, he was like a stroke off the lead. and he hits this really bad shot. And they come in close on his face, and he's just in anguish. You can see he's suffering. And Linda says, "Oh, I hope he doesn't commit karaoke." I hope so, too. Have you ever been there when somebody committed? Well, anyway, that's how it is at my house. I want to talk. I don't actually want to, but I'm going to talk about for a couple of minutes the worst thing I ever did. Please hear the preface. If you've done what I'm about to describe and it's okay with you, it's okay with me. I'm not here to judge you. I'm sharing this because there are probably a pretty good number of people in this room who need to get free on this one. And that's the reason I'm sharing it. This one's a political hot potato. I'm not talking about that. As a young man, I paid for an abortion. And that used to fester my soul. I used to think the what ifs that went with that. That's what I was thinking about the night in that treatment center when I asked God, when my soul screamed for forgiveness and got it. But when I got to the ninth step, it looked to me like I owed amends to an unborn child. I've been in the hands of people from my earliest days who knew how to read what was in this book. This is page 83. Some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter. And I was shown how to write that letter. I had also been taught to cry. There was a member of my home group taught me to cry when I was sober about a year. I was watching the very masculine guy. He's crying at every meeting. And I thought, I asked him, "Well, what is that about?" And he said, "Man, somebody says something beautiful and it touches me and I weep and it feels so good." And I said, "Tony, I can't cry." And he said, "I'll teach you." And he did. And I've been crying for about 4 days. I've been blocked for about a month. I just broke loose. And I've been crying all day. I cried sitting up here while some of the pre-stuff was going on. It's a wonderful thing for me. And it may be people here now that disrespect me because I'm a man that cries. That's all right with me. I hope you like me. I'm okay if you don't. Boy, I didn't have that when I got here. And I offer to teach you to cry, and I'm amazed about 40% of the people that ask me are women. I'm really surprised. But if you can't cry, if you'll see me afterward, I will show you how. I can actually teach it, and it's one of my great pleasures to do that. And also, it was my experience with this particular letter that it wasn't about the writing, it was the crying. It was the tears that went with it were the cleansing. And if you need to write a letter, if it's not an unborn child, a grandparent, somebody that's gone, I'd like to share my experience with you. Please, let's talk. I've written some of that stuff down. I'd like to show it to you. I serve a powerful God. Gave me a powerful program. More powerful than everything in my past. Whether they did it or I did it. More powerful than that. I serve a God that forgives me for everything I ever did and loved me while I was doing it. I don't have the power to make a mistake so ugly that God can't turn it into something magnificent. Not just fix. That's who I am. That's who He is. That's awfully important to me. I'll talk about anonymity for a minute. I use my last name in meetings in keeping with our tradition of anonymity. If that didn't make any sense to you, I'd like to recommend the book Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. We're not a secret society. We're not. But anonymity, I think, also means something else. It means doing something good and not getting caught. That's what it means. That's not my style. I'm a little bit into the applause. But I had an experience a number of years ago where I was able to do that. I did something neat for somebody, didn't get caught. And the experience I had was that like there was a piece of sunshine about the size of a golf ball lodged itself in my chest. And I could think about what I had done any time of the day or night. And this thing would glow and send light through my whole body. And I see a lot of people nodding to know what I'm talking about. So I never told a soul about that for about 6 weeks. And when I told, it got out. And I'm going to tell you about it because there was another lesson on the back end of this for me. What had happened was that I'm a commissioned salesman and I had a day full of appointments and I did the whole day by noon. You know, it would just click, 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 and I was done. I got the fishing gear in the back of the car. I pulled into a little state park, little creek running through. I'm fishing. There's a family having a picnic. They got about a 7-8-year-old boy who locks on my side. So I'm casting, handing it to him. We're catching fish, having a good time. Meet his family. They got no fishermen. And I got to know the family a little bit and took him fishing a couple of times, short trips. And then everybody was ready, and I thought he was really into it. And we launched a canoe on the Buffalo River. It's about an hour west of Nashville. It's a national scenic river. We floated 5.5 miles of river that day, caught over 100 fish. The kid caught a 4-pound smallmouth. He got my fish! About a mile from the takeout, all of a sudden the walls are straight up and there's no place to get out. The sky blackens and I can hear the thunder. We're fixing to get it. And I did what canoeists call eddy out. There's a little backwater. I kind of parallel parked the canoe up under these trees, and the raindrops are just, they're going to be bigger as my thumb. And I'm sitting in the back of the canoe and I'm about to give God a piece of my mind. Did you not happen to notice St. Scott and the boy and he caught my fish? And now you gotta, I'm just about to do that, and this beautiful boy looks over his shoulder at me and he says, "Is it okay to fish here?" I forget that. I prayed the third step prayer and I meant it. My life's none of my business anymore. And when the sky blackens in my life and it ain't going the way I want it to, I think that's the question I'm supposed to take to my Father. Is it okay to fish here? I think that's my assignment. That's what I signed on for. That's what I signed on for. It's an important thing for me to remember that that's what I signed on for. One of my mentors, a fellow named Don from the Denver area, died earlier this year. And in his honor, I just want to tell you a couple of the lessons I got from him. I asked him, and he was several years older than I, and about 2 years ago I said, "Don, what do you want to be when you grow up?" He said, "I know some grown-ups and I don't want what they have." And I said, what changes have you, he was sober at 30 odd years. I said, "What changes have you seen in AA?" And he said, "Today the focus seems to be on sobriety. When I was new, the focus was on recovery." And they're different. Sober is just not drinking today. Recovery is this continuing spiritual growth process that contains sobriety. But sobriety doesn't have to contain recovery. That was pretty powerful. And we, Miss Linda and I were able to spend Thanksgiving with he and his family this past year. And I had him alone for just a few minutes. And I was finally able to ask the question I've been wanting to ask him for a couple of years. And I've been scared to death of the answer. And the question was, what are guys like me going to do when guys like him are all gone? So I'm afraid of that answer. And this beautiful man cupped his hands like this and he looked at him and he said, "I have been bringing you hands full of water. Go to the river." What humility. And what an answer. What an answer. Yeah. And it is the answer. He was saying it wasn't him. See, I always thought it was him. He was saying it wasn't him. And before I forget to do it, it's real popular at some conferences to hear Saturday night and then go on home. Don't rob yourself. You need to hear my friend Ed tomorrow morning. He has got a spectacular message for you. I hope you're going to be here for it. I want to talk about a couple more things, and I'll let us get on to the dance. I lost my job a few months ago, and I've had a great job for a long time. I didn't have to do much. They paid me a lot of money. Not bad. But that little company got bought, and that's the way those things go. And Miss Linda and I are together on those kinds of things. And we did what we call a one-couple retreat, and we sequestered ourselves, and we prayed, and we've come up with about a 30-day plan, about as far out as we've been able to see. And we're doing some part-time work now. And we don't know what God's plan is, and we're not asking to know. We're asking, what would He have us do now? And I think that's a pretty good question. And the what would He have us do now thing, a couple of years ago, some friends of mine and I decided that giving our phone numbers to newcomers was a waste of time because they're not calling. We never call. What we do is we exchange phone numbers with new men, all right, and the ladies with the new ladies. And we call them. Not a lot. We don't chase them. But I task the men, my sponsor and myself, that you will not give your phone number to a new man. You will exchange with him and you will call him twice in the next 3 days. That's all. Say, "Hey, this is Scott. I met you at the back room on Sunday. I talk to 5 guys every day that are in recovery. You're on today's list. How's it going? I'm going to be at the fellowship group tonight, Nolensville Road. Meet me there. We'll have a cup of coffee. I got a speaker tape you might enjoy." It's nothing for me to call him. He can't call me. This thing about reaching out the hand of AA always being there, wonder what would happen if we reached it out just a little bit further. They're dying, you know. I carry a picture of me and my wallet taken of me when I was about 4 years old. If you ask me later, I'll show you. It's a beautiful little boy. And when I was living alone that 3 years, I had that thing blown up 2 feet wide and 3 feet high, and I didn't know why. Put it on the foot at the wall at the foot of the bed, and I'm laying there in bed one night looking at this thing, and this thought crossed my mind, and the thought was, I wonder who he would have become. I was abused as a child, and I want you to know that nothing happened in here when I just told you that. Because, you see, I've been through the forgiveness process in the 4-step, and writing it didn't have anything to do with that. Please find out what I'm talking about if you don't know. Please find out. But I'm looking there, and if all that hadn't happened to me and I hadn't done the things that I did, who would I become? And I got my answer. It showed up immediately, and the answer is, it is my assignment to become the man that he would have been. That's my job. I serve a powerful God. He gave me a powerful program. More powerful than all that stuff. The only question is, do I accept the assignment? That's the only question. And I want to take you flying again. My last mission in a high-performance plane, and I knew it was my last one. I released brakes and lit the burners and leveled at 40,000 feet. I'll tell you what that's like. You accelerate to 155 knots and you raise the nose wheel. She flies off at about 160. You raise the gear. At 1,000 feet, you raise the flaps and you begin to apply forward pressure to the stick, because this thing wants to climb like a homesick angel. And you hold her level at 1,000 feet to 600 knots. That's moving right along. And you pull it up and you level it at 40, 3.5 minutes from brake release. I'd just done that. And I was about 80 miles west of Jacksonville, up over the Okefenokee. And Jacksonville Center gave me what we call a barrel. It's a 30-mile circle around a point with an altitude block, because if you're going to play at 9/10 of the speed of sound, they have to give you some room. And they gave me more altitude than I was supposed to have. You're not supposed to be above 45,000 in this plane for a number of very good reasons. Most of them include your death. And I just kind of wondered how high it would go. Eased the power out of afterburner because the fuel gauges move kind of fast when you're in burner. And I rolled it into a little bit of a bank to keep me in this 30-mile circle. I'm doing 9/10 of the speed of sound. I got all the power this plane has except afterburner, what they call military power, and I'm climbing, doing an instrument climb. I have not looked outside. I'm what pilots call inside. I'm not supposed to be above 45. At 52,300, she was done. And I was down to less than 100 feet a minute rate of climb. I mean, this thing was finished. And I leveled out on a northerly heading, and I looked for the first time. 9:30, 10 o'clock in the morning on a clear day. The sun's coming up over my right shoulder. The sky above me is black at that time on a clear day. I looked out to the west and saw the curvature of the earth. And I don't mean a little bit. I mean, I saw it. This thing is a beautiful ball floating in space, held there by love, I guess. And what a beautiful, beautiful sight it was. And it was like something warm had been poured down me. It just ran down me very slowly. And I eased the throttles back and brought her down and landed. And I couldn't tell anybody if they believed me I was going to get court-martialed. I was the town drunk. I wasn't a village idiot, so I don't tell them. And I kind of forgot about it. And Burke Harlan was one of my mentors. Get one of Burke's tapes. What a fabulous human being. What a great teacher. And with a 5-year chip in my pocket, I talked at his 12-year birthday. And I started telling that story. And I remember saying, I wonder why I'm telling this. I got to the end and found out. And you know, it was my first spiritual experience. And I got to relive it then, by the way. Thank you. Because I just saw it again. And for over 30 years, I'd wanted to see the curvature of the earth again. 2 years ago, Miss Linda and I chartered a Learjet. A Lear 31 will go to 51,000. That's right. Dream big. We serve a big God. I'm the only one that can limit God's power in my life. Nobody else can do it. Nobody else can do it. I got here locked up like this, and what you've taught me to do is to open up to receive the gifts that have always been here. They've always been here. I quote my wife who says, God's will is a good deal. Yeah. That is important news for me. I'd like to thank that God. I asked for an open heart up here. I got it. This has been a quick time for me. I stand before you in stocking feet. We invited God into this room, and I try to hold that I'm standing on holy ground when we do that, and I step out of my shoes, and that's what I do when I stand up here. And I thank you for participating in that. if you borrowed my God and you got touched tonight, borrow them again. Borrow them again. We look forward to, thanks again, by the way, to the committee for allowing us to do workshops. Linda and I are doing meditation in the morning. Looking forward to that. She has a gift for guided imageries. And I like to close with a story that happened to me in Knoxville a number of years ago. I was visiting at a small group. It wasn't like a meeting like this, you know, a big speaker meeting where you could hide out. There's about 12 people in the room. They come around, they expect you to talk. And there was this fellow sitting there with a scowl on his face and his, you know, half glasses up. And I thought, oh, an attitude like case, I can't wait. And they got to him and he said, I've just come back from an ancient ritual, from a medieval ceremony where 10,000 people sat in an unair-conditioned auditorium wearing long robes. I figured it out. Graduation, University of Tennessee. I got it. That's commencement. I worked it out all by myself. And he said Alex Haley was the featured speaker. Mr. Haley spoke a lot around that part of Tennessee. It's where he lived. And he said Mr. Haley had just said his first few words, and this guy forgot about the air conditioning and the robes. And this guy said it described AA for him better than anything else he'd ever heard. And it does for me too. What Alex Haley said was, if you ever see a turtle sitting up on top of a fence post, you'll know he's had help. God bless you. Thank you for the help.